Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Thursday, September 4th. The Honolulu Marathon is just around the corner, and guess what? The number of runners is blowing by where we are at this time. So what could be behind the high numbers? Entries are up nearly 30% from last year. We get the latest on allegations of voting discrepancies in the last election on Kauai. Is it 600 or 6? On The Long View, we talk about a daring idea to shorten the work week by a day, no school on Friday. Plus, we meet a researcher who's uncovering connections between alcohol abuse and colonialism. And we hear from a favorite NPR voice on the importance of public radio. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The Honolulu Marathon is just 3 months away, but it's already on track for record-breaking numbers. Runners are signing up in a huge way. Honolulu Marathon President Jim Barrahall thinks it's in part due to a resurgence in the sport. We wondered about participation from Japan and Canada. But the marathon also saw funding from the Hawaii Visitors Bureau for the first time in its 53 years. Barrahall crunches the numbers.
We're over 32,000 entries right now, and we're early in September. So last year, our entries for the three events, the marathon, the Start to Park 10K, and the Kalakaua Mary Mile, our final entry count was a little over 36,000 last year. And so this year, we're tracking to about 45,000. It's going to be huge, staggering growth, about 28% from last year and about 60% over a two-year period. So it's growing rapidly, which is pretty amazing for an event that's been going on for 53 years now. So it's pretty amazing what's going on.
We worried a lot when the Japanese market fell apart with the yen, but you did have a pretty strong showing last year, right?
Yeah, no, we were still at almost 11,000 last year from Japan. So that was very strong, going to far outpacing Japanese tourism to Hawaii overall. And so this year we're up 28% in the Japan market. So we're tracking to probably close to 13,000 people from Japan. These are participants. And keep in mind that when people travel from Japan and elsewhere, they tend to bring people with them. They don't travel alone. And so this is going to be an enormous amount of people from Japan coming as well. But it's interesting in the growth of the Honolulu Marathon, really since COVID, that the demographics have changed completely with this huge growth. The Japanese participation now is about 27%, and it's 73% from outside of Japan, whereas in some of the boom years in the 90s, when Japanese tourism was at an all-time high to Hawaii, the Japanese participation in the marathon was over 70%. So we've had huge growth, while at the same time, the growth is coming from other markets, and we're still strong in the Japan market. So I think it's hard to predict external factors that we can't control, such as the exchange rate being the biggest one from Japan, but other factors. But I think we're really poised for even more growth as these other markets have grown tremendously.
What can you tell us about the other markets?
To start with California, in the last 2 years, since 2023, we're up 128% in California. And that's always been our largest mainland market, as it is for Hawaii tourism in general. So we're up 128% in a two-year period from California, 44% from last year. So that's huge growth. Internationally, Canada from last year is up 36%, and over a two-year period, it's up 65%. Europe, we're up 19%, and over a two-year period, we're up 61%. South Korea, we're up 289% from last year.
Really?
Yeah. And so, granted, those aren't big markets. If you look at South Korea for the marathon, we had 65 people from South Korea in last year, and this year we have 253 people entered already. So that's 289%, but it's still a relatively small market. But it shows that the growth is coming from all over, and it's been the staggering growth that I'd like to say we planned that out, but it's not completely. It just happened, and so it's pretty amazing to see this. It's been unfolding all year.
Well, what does this tell us about what maybe the resurgence of running and long distance running?
Well, there's no question there's a running boom going on again. I'm old enough to remember the running boom of the 70s, which kind of, I guess I was a part of. Baby boomers were part of that running boom, and it was huge. And that lasted really through the 70s, I think, into the early 80s. But if you look at events and what's happened, you have to look at COVID as being a real kind of delineator almost. And if you look at the Honolulu Marathon, our last pre-COVID race, 2019, and then the rough times came with COVID. There was no travel and races shut down. And that created a lot of problems, not only for races, but all kinds of problems in society. And I think young people were particularly affected by it. And so as we came out of COVID, we're finding this phenomenon that people, the running boom, I think, is connected to COVID and the isolation during COVID. As people wanted to get out, they wanted to meet people, and the running has become a real area where people have gravitated towards. Running clubs have become very popular. Lots of young people, they get to meet other people. They engage in a healthy activity. The bar scene, from all reports I read, is down. The alcohol consumption among the 20s people is down from what it used to be. So running has assumed this huge role with these running clubs and the social aspect of it coming out of COVID. And so certainly the Honolulu Marathon and a lot of other events are really experiencing huge growth. The large marathons in particular are experiencing huge growth.
And you have had support from Japan Airlines, right, for a number of years. But what are your concerns as far as like airlift from other places?
Japan Airlines has been with us for many years. We're in our fourth decade with them. We do have a new relationship with them in the sense that Japan Airlines, starting this year, will be the title sponsor of the marathon. So it will be called the JAL Honolulu Marathon. We're excited about that. We're excited to extend and deepen this relationship with Japan Airlines and their commitment to bringing more people from Japan to Hawaii, not only for the marathon, but all year round. So it's a real vote of confidence in the marathon. And the numbers, the increasing numbers for the marathon show that there's still great possibilities for Japanese tourism to Hawaii. Japan Airlines will be adding some lift capacity during the marathon to get even more people here. So that's been a huge part of our success in Japan for a long time, and I think this renewed commitment is going to be very exciting. Another thing that happened last year is we did get some funding from the HTA, and we used a lot of those dollars to market in California. And I think this huge growth that we're getting in California has to in part be credited to the support we're getting from the state, from Governor Josh Green, who's a huge supporter of the marathon, and of course Mayor Blangiardi. Jimmy Tokioka has also been a huge supporter. So I think there's a number of factors at play, but certainly we've done targeted marketing into California in a way that the Honolulu Marathon has never been able to do before. So I'd like to think that that support is also helping us in that really key market.
Are you worried, though, that we might lose some airlift?
Well, I'm not worried about it because Japan Airlines, I think that this title sponsorship is such a huge commitment from Japan Airlines that they really see the Honolulu Marathon as an important event, and they really see Hawaii as a key market. So I can tell you from my conversations with top executives at Japan Airlines is there's no lack of commitment and belief in Japanese tourism to Hawaii. They believe that in it strongly. The Japanese people love Hawaii. They love the culture, like hula and different Hawaiian culture things are so important in Japan. They believe very strongly, and I think this title sponsorship, which is a huge commitment from them in a number of ways, both in terms of sponsorship level, airlift, just deepening the relationship, I think is going to really reap rewards for Hawaii over the next few years. I think the marathon is the first beneficiary of this, but I don't think it's going to be the only one. I do think that we're going to see growth. The exchange rate is still problematic. It's stabilized a little bit, but I think once the exchange rate does come down some more, I think we'll see more people from Japan. And if you put that on top of the growth we're having from other markets, I think the marathon can get even bigger in the years to come.
That was Honolulu Marathon's president, Jim Barahal, talking about the huge increase in the number of runners in all categories, international, U.S., and local entries.
Tracing the path of human migration sometimes means hitching a ride on a cargo ship.
These vessels are kind of the workhorses or the modern camels of like globalization.
We check in with National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek as he travels across the globe, mostly on foot. That conversation and more global news next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
You know, there's lots of buzz around the next election, but there are still loose ends from the last go-around. Specifically here in Hawaii, discrepancies over Kauai's election. Is it 6 votes or 600? Big difference. Here with the latest brouhaha is HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so we've talked about this.
Yes.
Big difference here.
Yes, exactly. You know, so earlier this summer, the State Elections Commission issued a permitted interaction group report regarding the 2024 Kauai election. And that report alleged that the Office of Elections counted over 600 more votes than it received through vote by mail. And because of that report, the commission last week voted to audit the 2024 election using an independent accounting firm, which will likely cost somewhere between $100,000 to $200,000 from taxpayers to do that. But the Office of Election says that permitted interaction group report is not correct and issued its own report in response, including all of the attachments that report that the Office of Elections put out is over 1,000 pages long. And what it really comes down to is that permitted interaction group report from the Elections Commission relies on an unofficial manual count of daily Dropbox pickups of mail-in ballots by Kauai County. And that manual count is meant to be used as a way to estimate staffing needs throughout the election period. So tracking to see how many they're like waiting for so they're not understaffed on like the last day of the election or something like that. And so that permitted interaction group report used those unofficial counts to conclude that there was an over 600 vote discrepancy in the amount of ballots that were actually counted. Chief Elections Officer Scott Nago emphasized that, you know, that manual count was never meant to be used as a check on the elections process, and that manually counting envelopes is really prone to error because people, you know, make mistakes while they're counting. And many of the records were handwritten, so there were errors that had to be corrected as these unofficial manual counts that were further scrutinized by the commission were looked at by the elections office. So, for example, one of the handwritten entries that was part of that manual count, the number 91 was crossed out, but part of the 1 was still visible. And so when they corrected it to 88, instead it got recorded as 188 votes, things like that. Or like in another instance, one of the unofficial counts of mail received by USPS was missing an entry, and then someone wrote in 3,000 were hand counted. But after counting the receipts from USPS, that number was actually close to 3,400. And so, you know, in the end, after correcting these errors and adding up the USPS receipts, Nago says the difference from the unofficial count and the official one, which is through the statewide voter registration system, was small, only 6 votes.
The more time we can look for discrepancies and error. So that's why those numbers are a little different from the initial report that we submitted a month earlier, because the more time you have, the more you can look at things and figure it out. We're seeing that the statewide voter registration system is the official numbers, and the reason it's correct is because we've added up all those BRM receipts and we don't come up with a discrepancy of 600, we come up with a difference of 6.
So if they don't use those manual counts as a check, you know, you might be wondering, how does the Office of Elections ensure that it's not counting more or less ballots than it actually receives? So the Office of Election uses what's called an over-underage report to check if it's counting the correct number of ballots. It compares the number of valid envelopes collected to the number of ballots counted. And it does this for in-person voting as well by recording the number of people who walked in and then the number of ballots cast. So for the election on Kauai in 2024, the over-underage report showed that there were just 25 more mail-in ballots counted than there were envelopes. It's an error of less than 0.1%. And in fact, the over-underage report for the mail-in votes actually had a lower percentage error than the in-person voting results. And so the state Supreme Court can intervene in an election if the results are in question and the vote difference is significant. Election Commissioner Ralph Cushney and 30 plaintiffs challenged the 2024 election actually back then during the challenge period. And the Supreme Court actually ruled against them as the closest race on Kauai County had roughly 100 vote margin. Cushney has also filed a similar complaint in the Supreme Court in 2022, which was also struck down. Nago says that these types of accusations from the commission take away focus from what they need to be doing and planning for, which is the 2026 election.
It just takes away your focus. Instead of focusing on elections, you're focusing on dispelling a rumor or some conspiracy theory. So rather than focusing on the 2026 election, we're still focusing on the 2024 election and all the different things, trying to show how it's a legitimate election.
And, you know, last year I reported on this commission and how it's become one that really focuses on these election security issues versus things like expanding voter access, like opening more polling places or looking for ways to decrease lines on election day. And, you know, at that time I spoke with Lizzie Ulmer, who is the senior vice president of States United Action, a nonpartisan nonprofit dedicated to protecting elections. And I asked her, you know, how election officials should respond to these types of allegations, especially when it's one after the other. For example, the Elections Commission is taking on another permitted interaction group next month that has similar allegations.
How much it can impact from both a resource, time, and energy component for local election officials across the country when they are consistently and constantly having to deal with the same questions, faith and lies and misinformation about our elections over and over and over again. It's incredibly important for them to stay consistent and strong in defending the free, fair, and secure elections that they run, emphasizing that system of checks and balances in place and all of the ways in which they are working with other local officials and statewide officials to make sure that things are secure and accurate for voters where they live.
You know, the current makeup of the State Elections Commission is majority Republican appointees, as two of the four Democrat appointees have actually stepped down. So now there are four Republican appointees, the chair of the commission, who was once a Republican appointee, and then just two Democrat appointees. And, you know, both Democrat appointees voted against the audit of the 2024 Kauai election results. And it's really not clear who would have to pay for the audit, whether that comes out of the Office of Elections budget or if it would need legislative approval to get that money that they would need to do that.
Any word on when those appointees, you know, might get replaced?
I haven't heard anything yet on when that was. They stepped down relatively recently, maybe within the last month or so. So it's a very recent change to the commission.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really kind of rejiggered the way that these votings are going to go, because usually when they vote on these types of reports and things, it's usually a 5-4 split, kind of like down the line ideologically, with sometimes the chair will kind of go back and forth between voting with the Republican faction or
right.
the Democrats.
So still uncertainty at
yeah,
this point.
A lot of uncertainty.
And, you know, we did talk to Scott Nago because of the President Donald Trump had made some comment that he was looking at an executive order to do away with mail-in balloting, which is what we do here in Hawaii.
Right.
So, yeah, he says it's that's a concern, right?
Because and the majority of people here do vote by mail. And I wanted to say, too, that this commission is actually in charge of hiring and firing the chief elections officer. So there is a situation where they could, you know, oust elections officer Scott Nago if that's what they decided to do.
Yeah, well, stay tuned, right? All right, well, thank you so much, Ashley. We've been talking to HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. She has the latest on the flap over Kauai's elections. On the Long View this morning, our contributing editor, Neil Milner, focuses on the four-day work week, specifically in our schools. Does it help retain and recruit teachers? And more importantly, does it impact learning? Good morning.
Good morning. It's technically not a four-day work week. It's a four-day in-class week.
Okay.
And I thought this would be a good time to bring it up because it's the beginning of the school year and it addresses, at least in theory, not necessarily in practice, two things that are chronic issues in public schools in Hawaii. One is teacher recruitment, and the second one is how students are doing their scores. So the four-day work week, that is 4 days with students and the other day for other kinds of activities, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence. Most of it, it turns out, doesn't hold up when you do the research. And we'll get back to that in a second. But this has been around for a while. Rural districts use it because they're short of staff, the same reason they have seven-person football teams. They don't have enough, right? So, and other suburbs have begun to adopt it, and Texas is going whole hog. And the anecdotal evidence is that there's a real buzz. More people show up to recruitment sessions and so on. It turns out the evidence isn't that good for that. It's not very good at all. It's mostly buzz. And it turns out, and we'll backtrack because there's a lot of ifs here, it turns out that students don't benefit from this. And in fact, the evidence that exists tends to say they do worse under these kind of systems. So when you look at this kind of stuff, you really have to understand two things. One is how education reform works, and also what schools are, because schools are more than just places you educate kids. And a four-day work week where the students are somewhere else for a fifth day changes things. But so let me point out a couple things here that I think is really important to understand. First of all, it's very hard to get definitive education research at all because the whole education system is so decentralized. Mm-hmm. It's hard to run studies. So a lot of this research is based on places in different places done in different sorts of ways. There's tendencies that you can read, like the tendencies I just gave, but this is a typical kind of problem in educational reform. It's not just that the methods of research are limited. It's just it's such an enormous task.
Yeah, it's hard to get
to get stuff. So the most recent research on it comes out of I believe it's Oregon State that looked at some more quality stuff. So they come up with things, some of which I mentioned here. It appears. Well, one of the things they say is how it affects or doesn't affect different schools depends on what the schools are like. So it's a depends thing. They argue, though, that overall it doesn't seem to help students. It hurts them. And that's about as good research as you're going to get right now. So if the DOE is looking for some kind of panacea here, some kind of way of recruiting more teachers. It doesn't say anything about retention, but recruiting more teachers, this doesn't guarantee it by any means. If the DOE is looking at ways to deal with school scores, with student learning, remember, since COVID, student learning nationally the scores have dropped. We're not doing very well. The answer is it's you certainly can't depend on it. So that's where we are, and to me, the interesting thing is why people are still interested in it anyway, because it's not something that's going to be the magic bullet by any means. So my response to that is a couple things, one of which nothing in education will change is a magic bullet. The things are too complicated. We always find that it depends comes in. The second thing is that so much of educational change is political that people who are in favor of it will find a way to show that it's good, in quotes. And I think that's what's happening in Texas. That essentially it's getting adopted around there because important people think it's going to work and that builds the process. The third thing, though, is this coming back to this idea of the school is much more than a school. All you have to do is put yourself into the life of a parent here. And remember, schools are there partially because they have a place that you can put your child for long periods of time. Schools are there because there it's a place where many kids get the most nutrition and maybe the only nutrition that they get. So you go from five days to four days. Schools are there to keep kids out of trouble so they're not walking on the street. And just imagine if you got a five-year-old child is in school 4 days a week. The days may be longer because you got to have the same hours. On the fifth day, you got to find something to do. You know, you already have tutus overworked. You don't want to pay for daycare. All of this stuff is very much a part of the school, so that all of these kinds of things make the decision even more complicated.
We saw what happened with Furlough Fridays, right? Everybody was in a tizzy because of what do we do about the kids?
Sure. And it's, maybe you get some kind of ancillary industry that develops, like a 1 day a week. Although lots of parents would just as soon not see their kids 4 days a week and have them the fifth day. But you're right. It does throw things in a tizzy, and understandably so, especially if it's not an old-fashioned neighborhood where you could, years ago, you could leave your kid out. People don't want to do that anymore.
Right. And then I'm thinking back over the years, when we had the teacher strike, those kinds of things.
Well, even COVID is another good example of what happens. And so the school plays, the nutrition one is very interesting. When my granddaughter lived in Brooklyn, they lived in a neighborhood that was a kind of a mixed neighborhood in all kinds of ways. She was taking swimming lessons at a public pool where every day the city delivered lunch. He delivered lunch because a lot of those kids, including her classmates, depended on that meal for nutrition every day, and just because school isn't in session. So this is what makes education reform so difficult, and it also reminds me how much this is involving things that are not just whether it works or not. But it's pretty clear it's not a panacea.
Yeah, I mean, when you think back, because, you're no spring chicken. You've been here 50 years. Your kids went to public school. And you just have seen the changes. And here, Hawaii has a centralized Department of Education, one department.
Sure, right. That doesn't do a very good job of administering almost anything. And that's big changes, big reform changes. If I were to pick people who could do or institution that could do a big reform change, I don't think I would choose our DOE. That's not their whatever their strong suit is. That's not it.
Well,
I want to get back to that spring chicken a second.
but it's interesting, right? You want to figure out how can we improve learning in our schools. And
the
how
answer
do we help our teachers?
No, I mean, the answer, that's a very difficult question, partly because so much of how you learn and what you learn has to do with your background, which has to do with socioeconomic status. We know from the research, from birth on, there is a difference in the process by which lower SES and others learn. It's a built-in inequality. There are ways to deal with it, but so you're only working with the margins because you have these class differences.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll bet that it ain't gonna happen here anytime soon.
Yes.
But thank you so much, Neil.
Okay. Take care.
We've been talking to Neil Milner, who joined us in studio with the Reflective Longview today. How can we improve public education? Look for links to articles on this on our website later today.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor The Hidden Nene.
Looking for cool, unique experiences and events happening across our Hawaiian Islands? Let your new HPR besties show you the way. Introducing HPR's Social Club newsletter. Every Wednesday, get the latest happenings straight to your inbox. Sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org/socialclub.
Support for HPR comes from Big Island Coffee Roasters' 15th anniversary celebration, online September 18th to 21st, featuring Kona Noir, Kau Yellow Bourbon, and more. BigIslandCoffeeRoasters.com/anniversary.
You know, doctors routinely ask for our family medical histories, but what if they also took our cultural and ethnic histories into account when treating us? Cynthia Graywolf is a nurse scientist who's made it her life's work to address the whys of addiction and alcohol abuse. She's an assistant professor at the University of Hawaii at Manoa Nursing School and is one of 25 American Indian nurses who hold a doctorate degree. Graywolf grew up on the Cherokee Nation Reservation in Oklahoma. Part of her dissertation was recently published in the Asia-Pacific Island Nursing Journal. Graywolf spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about culturally informed nursing and the link between health issues and the historical trauma of colonialism. And a note, this segment talks about suicide.
My grandfather, who was Cherokee, was an alcoholic, as were many people in my family. And as a consequence of that, he had many health issues. He eventually ended up committing suicide. And I was still fairly young when that happened. And of course, that was very devastating for me and my family. And as I grew up, I always wondered why. There were always a lot of unanswered questions for me. I eventually had the opportunity to become a nurse. And I worked for many years as an RN before I went back to school, and I became a psychiatric NP first, eventually completing the other doctorate, a DNP, and practiced in a lot of very rural settings. And I practiced mainly with American Indians, Native Hawaiians in rural settings, and I used trauma-informed care to treat a lot of individuals that had been incarcerated, for example, had problems with alcohol, methamphetamine, and other drugs. So it was really my own family history that drove me to being interested in this and to try to find answers to questions about the why that I always asked when I was a kid. So that's what drives my research today, is to try to find the risks and the protective factors that are involved with these indigenous groups, and to help find interventions that are going to really be effective and to help prevent these types of problems.
And tell us a bit about your research into historical trauma and alcohol use among Hawaiians, just how those first questions formed in your mind and how you investigated them.
One of the questions I always had was, does alcohol, did it exist in Hawaii prior to colonization? Because it didn't exist on the U.S. mainland prior to colonization. There were some tribes that had like a mild brew. And from what I've been able to read about it from experts, those types of brews are very highly regulated by the tribes. And so they didn't become a problem. And I was curious, you know, because alcohol was disseminated amongst American Indians and became a problem. It's kind of that dissemination of alcohol provides foundation of alcohol problems we have today. And I was curious about that with Native Hawaiians. And anecdotally, I knew there was a problem in the area I was working. And so that's where the question really became. And then I could see a lot of people would self-medicate with it. And so I was wondering, I had many, many questions about that. And I had some pretty good ideas, you know, because I had been studying historical trauma for a while and having really, unfortunately, I've lived that as well. It's been passed intergenerationally, mm-hmm. you know, so it's sort of unavoidable in some ways. One of the things that I have always noticed in my patients, for example, when I was treating them, is that people would drink because it helped to numb their feelings, they said. And to numb the feelings, like when you think about like historical trauma, what does that mean? Well, historical trauma is mass group trauma to a population of people. And colonization is that. So it causes a lot of damage. It causes a lot of structural harms. It causes a lot of relational harms. It causes a lot of knowledge-based harms, right? Part of the problem with relational harms is you have fracturing of families. You have fracturing of communities. You have loss of traditional ways. You have loss of lands. You have many, many losses, loss of languages. And with that, there's grieving. Diseases took many Native people, and you may know that, you know, that there have been estimated, I believe, 800,000 to a million Native Hawaiians prior to contact when Captain Cook came, which dwindled down 95% of the population because of diseases. Right? The same thing happened on the U.S. mainland with American Indians and Alaska Natives as well, a lot of losses. And then, of course, the loss of lands. And that's one of the major things that I would hear from people is the loss of, it's like identity, land, people, and traditions.
Yeah. It kind of boils down to this question of how can understanding history, understanding the past, broaden or explain what we face in the present? One question I have for you is just like how this broader understanding and how some of the research that you do can influence that patient-provider relationship, how that can influence the way that a provider talks to, treats, interacts with patients.
I'll give you an example. I was in the Southwest a few years ago, and I worked with the Navajo or the Diné population. And the place that I worked had a court contract so that we would receive all the people that had been incarcerated. And they would often come to us while they were on probation. Part of their journey was to have psychiatric care. So to give you an example, I had a Diné man who came in to see me. He had been arrested for public intoxication, and he had been destroying property, been in altercations with the police and other people around. But this wasn't the first time. This was probably like the 30th time that he had been incarcerated. So he had been coming to the community health center for a long time. When I looked at his chart, being a psych provider and being also an American Indian, I looked and I was looking at his chart and I was thinking about historically traumatic events that kind of was the underpinning of his experience and a lot of post-traumatic stress that was, you know, happening, which was more proximally. He had every possible diagnosis you can imagine from a psychiatric perspective, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, you name it, he had it because he had had so many providers and these diagnoses were adding up. He was on, I can't tell you how many medications, but a lot of them. Problem was he weighed 400 something pounds. And I could see that he was like in his late 30s and he had all these medical comorbidities. And I guess long story short, I knew that those diagnoses weren't necessarily correct. There was a lot of substance involved, so I think a lot of the psychosis he experienced were related to that. But over a two-year period of working with him with trauma-informed care and getting him to buy into the treatment plan, I got him down to one medication, diagnosed him with complex post-traumatic stress disorder and methamphetamine and alcohol use disorders over 2.5 years. He also lost over 200 pounds by weaning off some of the antipsychotic medications he was on. Mm-hmm. They had maxed him out on the medications. It probably was going to kill him at some point because it was like a chemical restraint, it looked like. And I just went at it from a different approach than, say, somebody who looks at it more from the, I guess, more of a Western point of view, who's not familiar with historical trauma, who doesn't look at trauma as the base for why somebody might be drinking, using methamphetamine, and getting into these public fights and getting arrested.
That must have been a really meaningful experience for you as a clinician, being able to approach that from a different framework and see very obvious reaction.
Yes, it was. I had to realize too, I mean, just to throw in there, one of the things that I had at my disposal was there was a medicine man who would work with our facility, and I got this patient involved with him as well, so that I had him and me. And it was like really trying to reintegrate him into his culture was a big thing, since I'm not Diné. This is why this particular gentleman that was working with us is so important. He integrated sweat lodge treatments and reintegrated this man into learning and having pride about being Diné. You know, turns out he was a great artist, and he got back involved in doing art and actually selling it again, which I think that he could have really been successful. The frustration is that a lot of providers that come into a place like that, they don't recognize that this is a problem, you know, historical trauma. They're not aware of the trauma that people like that have experienced, and that they continue to experience it every time they go to jail. And it's like this constant, like, just recidivism, you know, and it's like trying to really find a way to really help this man. Mm-hmm. It took me 2.5 years, a long time, a lot of risk and everything, to get him off all these medications, but eventually we were able to do that. So it would, I think, take a lot of education to have providers come in and be educated about the population. A lot of it is also cultural safety. What that is you have to meet somebody where they're at and basically get their buy-in, mm-hmm. you know, like, what is it that they want to receive from me? And I didn't want them, you know, as a provider, you have the disadvantage of having the power differential, and I would remove that power differential. So I had to tell him a little bit about my story to get him to buy in, you know, to talk to me. It took a while to gain that trust.
That was nurse scientist Cynthia Graywolf. She spoke with HBR's Maddie Bender about the link between historical trauma and addiction. We'll have a link to her research on our website later today. In the 7 weeks since Congress voted to rescind $9 billion that had already been allocated for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, public radio stations across the country have been scrambling to figure out what the future looks like. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson recently talked about the current state of affairs with the familiar voice, Michelle Martin, host of National Public Radio's Morning Edition. Martin shared her journey through public media and offered her perspective on the role of public radio in today's media landscape.
We like to talk here at HPR about all the winding roads that can lead people to public radio. I'm curious, could you give our listeners just a little background on how you got here?
Sure. I started in newspapers. I had a summer internship at the Washington Post. I tell people I graduated on June 5th. I took my driver's license exam on June 6th. I drove to Washington on June 8th under supervision, thankfully. And the woman who had been my RA in college was also moving to Washington, thankfully. So we drove together, brave woman.
Yeah.
And I started at the Washington Post on June 10th. So I was a summer intern there. And at the end of that summer internship, I got what at the time, I don't know if they still have this, was like an extended internship that they had, and kind of like an apprenticeship program. And after a year of it, it was supposed to be a 2-year program, but after about 9 months in it, they terminated that and gave me a staff job. Did all the things at the Post. You know, the Post is famous for political coverage, so I did a lot of that. Covered the county council, state legislature. Then went to the Wall Street Journal, where I eventually became the White House correspondent. And then after that, I went to ABC News, where I was for a number of years and worked on a number of shows. I worked mainly on 2 shows there, a show called Day One, a magazine show, and then I worked at Nightline with Ted Koppel. And then after that, came to NPR. And this is my third show at NPR. So yes, kind of those, like those winding roads in Hawaii, right?
Right. And you got that driver's license and you went right to the work. I mean, some people, you know, they try this, they try that, but you knew exactly what you were doing. I love it. I love it.
Well, you know, it's funny that that analogy, because when I first came to the attention of NPR, they asked me if I would, the head of programming then was in charge of recruiting. He asked me if I would consider being a contributor to someone else's show at the time. And I honestly had no thoughts of saying this, but I said to him, this is true. He would back this up. I said, nope, I'm tired of being a passenger. I'm ready to drive.
Nice.
So when you're ready to give me the keys, I'm ready to drive. And he was like, oh. And I walked out of there thinking, what did I just do? But yeah, it worked out.
Fantastic. I think the public radio is defined by people who aren't afraid to get behind the wheel and drive. I mean, it's certainly an enterprising world. And but I wonder, when people who know you and know what you do, know that you work in public radio, ask you how you're doing in regards to the loss of public funding, I wonder, how do you answer a question like that?
You know, it's so funny that you said that, because this is something I've been talking about. I'm glad we have a chance to talk about this. I was on vacation about 2 weeks ago, and then came back, was hosting, was on the show, and then I went to a journalism conference, and people were asking me, like, how are you doing? You know, are you okay? And I'm glad I have the chance to say, we're not going anywhere. We are not going anywhere. And I would think that people would know that, but I kind of understand why they don't. Yes, it is true that there has been a significant loss of funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which it's a big hit. You can't lose $1 billion in funding and have it not be a big hit. But the reality of it is, it's a small part of our funding overall, overall. Yes, it's true that some of the stations are going to be hit harder than others. You know, some of our stations are in places that are certainly rich in culture. They are certainly rich in story, and they certainly serve a vital need, but they are in places that don't have a lot of excess capital that people can readily share. So that's where the public funding comes in, because it has been important over the 50-year history of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to be sure that people all over the country have access to this kind of work. But my answer is, we are going to continue to do what we do. We know what our mission is. Our mission is to report on what's important to our audience around the country and around the world. We're going to keep doing that. Obviously, we're going to have to figure out some new ways of doing that. But we have a learning mindset here. I mean, this is one of the reasons why I think that we have been successful over the years, is we have a learning mindset. And we figure out how to get the story where it is, and then how to bring the story to people where they are. And that is what we do. That's what we're going to continue to do. Like, for example, I was at this conference, and one of the people who's a very distinguished journalist, I'm not going to call his name, I was at a panel discussion. This journalist was asked, gee, you know, are there stories that aren't getting the attention they deserve? And he said, well, Sudan, you know, we just can't get in there. And I'm thinking, excuse me, I have been to Sudan. I was there last year I went with our then UN ambassador, Linda Thomas Greenfield. We went through Chad. It took, you know, what? Almost like 23 hours to get there. We got there. We were at the border as refugees came across. Our colleague, Emmanuel Akinwotu, who's based in Lagos, has been to Sudan twice by now. So I was really interested to hear this journalist who works for well-resourced as any news organization is at this point say, well, you know, we can't get in. Well, we've been there three times.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are doing the work, and I'm just hoping that we are making the value proposition clear.
I think there's some kind of marriage there between, or analogy at least, between getting behind the wheel right after graduating and a learning approach to life and work. I think those two things come together in that story. I have one last question for you. We have 10% of our listeners here at HPR who support us. And as we've lost the funding from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, we've looked to double that. We want to get 20% of our listeners to support us. And so our approach is that we want all of our listeners to get one person to come to the party, one plus one. Do you have any advice for our listeners on how to get their plus one to come to the Hawaii Public Radio party?
You know, I think, TW, I think you probably know better than I what your audience, you know, wants to hear and what's appealing to them. But again, I'd make the value proposition. What are you enjoying? What are you learning from? What are you listening? What are the things that improve your life? What are the things that you want to know about that we can share with you, that we bring to you? I know I recently Yeah, I don't know if you did this interview too, that she used to work here. She's at the Washington Post, Sarah Kehlani Koo, who recently did a memoir.
Yes, I just spoke to her.
You just talked to her?
Yes.
Did you? Oh, that's awesome. And, you know, I'd known her for years. I had no idea of her backstory. I mean, I knew her as a great editor. Yeah. You know, she's a great editor. She's a great colleague. But what a revelation to find out that this person who sat like 6 feet from me had this incredible story. So magnify that times 10,000. That to me is the story right there. Like, you know, and what's it going to be if there aren't people to bring those stories to you? I think that's kind of how I like to think of it. You know, I don't know if you ever do this. Sometimes, like, if I have a moment and like maybe if you have a chance to sit outside and, you know, people watch and you think, gosh, I wonder what story you have in there. Mm. Like, what story are you walking around with?
Yeah.
And if you think about it, that's our job, is to bring you those stories from people. Oftentimes, of course, we connect with people when they're at their worst day or their best day. But the other thing I really appreciate about public media is we don't just connect with you on your worst day or your best day. We connect with you in between. The things that are happening in your life that are just important and interesting. And that, to me, is those gray areas. That's not like the, you know, when a big, big, giant, crazy thing happens, everybody's going to rush there. Mm. And when, you know, something amazing happens, like, I don't know, somebody wins the lottery. I don't know. Think about it. You know, you're going to hear about it. But we're there for those in-between moments because we live where you live. And we have the benefit of this network across the country and, in fact, bureaus around the world where we can tell you what's happening across the street, across the county, across the state, across the country, across the world. I think that's the value proposition. I hope that people get that message. And I know you're going to help make that message real.
I couldn't have put it better myself at all. Thank you so much, Michelle. Really appreciate you taking the time today.
Well, thank you so much. And you know what? Next time, maybe we'll do an interview in your studio, right? Like, you know.
Come on over. We got room for you, for
sure. Okay, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, because I can't just show up when invited. Well, I would, but.
Consider yourself invited.
Okay.
Be well, Michelle. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
That was NPR Morning Edition host Michelle Martin talking to HBR's G.W. Gibson about the role of public media in the wake of federal funding cuts. Well, that's it for us today. Up tomorrow, we plan to take a tour of a marine debris recycling center on Oahu. They are running out of time to shore up funding for a new home. Give us some feedback. Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation. Thank you.